The cinema specialists are back, and I gave John the obligation of tweeting, so he's not prepared, but I figured I'd put him on the spot and let him fumble his way through here. Tonight, we are talking about Black Widow and The Killer. The Killer was a movie that John and I had discussed doing, I don't know, back when it came out, whatever day that was. I don't remember exactly what week.
It's like, but it was the beginning of November sometime.
It was. Like, it was really a long time ago that we had said, you know what? We're going to watch this movie. It's time. And we just never did. And then finally, we hit a lull week. Mean Girls comes out this week, so obviously we'll be doing Mean Girls. But we said, okay, it's finally time to watch The Killer. And after watching it, I'm not overly shocked it didn't get like more hype than it did, but it was fine. And we'll talk about it.
Yep.
it's really what I have to say about that. But we're also doing Black Widow, which I believe is probably the most accurate depiction of Russian culture we have ever seen and discuss on this podcast. So I just want to throw that out there first. All those bullshit movies John made us watch back in our top 100. If you haven't checked that out, Stalker, Mirror, Heart of a Dog. What else am I missing? Whatever was in there, Battleship Potemkin. John made us watch all these Russian movies. And I got to say, Black Widow just knocked it out of the park in the way that that John's movies just couldn't do it. They just couldn't get to that level. I apologize, John.
Yeah, no, not at all. I can't even agree with that statement. Like, Black Widow is going to be a very fun one to discuss because I think we had very differing opinions on it. But it seems like we had very similar opinions on The Killer.
Yeah, and The Killer is where we're going to start. It was just like, okay, so here's my thing with The Killer. And I liked it. And I thought some of it was really so well made. I mean, it's got a confident tone. It's got a confident script, even if the script is a little nonsense at times. But it's a confident script. It's a confident tone. Great performance from Michael Fassbender. The direction is there. And yet when it was over, I was like, that is a quintessential three-star movie. And I'm not surprised that some people felt it was even worse than a three-star movie. But nothing made me say, this is just perfection. I really enjoyed the opening. I really enjoyed the premise. I really enjoyed the movie. But for some reason, I was just still left wanting more by the end of it. And somebody like asked me in one of our videos, I don't remember which video it was. I think it might've been our year-end review. So go ahead and watch that if you haven't checked that out. But I think it was our year-end review. They had asked, Phil, how does your ranking system work? What's the difference between a 3 and a 3.5? And like a 4-star movie is perfect. Like a 4-star movie, there's a couple things maybe here and there that you'd say, that didn't work, but you're invested, you're emotionally invested, it makes you emotional, whatever. 3.5 stars is close to 4, but there's something missing. It's like a really good movie that has kept me invested and everything like that, but there might have been a decision here or there, or it might have lagged a bit in a part, or maybe some of the acting wasn't great or whatever. A 3-star movie is kind of like, it's a good movie, but it doesn't do anything special. And 3-star movies are normally the ones that you go back and you'd watch back in the day when you would actually throw on cable and just put on whatever was on. TNT and TBS and AMC and TCM, even HBO, they were the kings of the 3-star movie. That's what people would watch. I mean, that's why, you'd get Michael Bay movies all the time, even though his are generally a little bit less than a 3-star movie. It's those types of movies that you can just turn on, you can pick them up at any time and watch it. Now, The Killer is not really a movie that you can just pick up at any time and watch it. But it was a good movie. There's nothing really bad about it, but there's nothing really great about it. And so that's why I landed at 3. And I don't know, John, it seems like you felt the same way.
Yeah, I was kind of struggling if I felt that this was a 3 or a 3.5-star movie, because there were moments of this film that were really well done. Yeah. And you could tell that there is someone very versed with film working behind the scenes, like David Fincher, obviously. What, I had 3 David Fincher movies in my top 100 that we discussed. No, 4. There were 4 of them. Now that I think about it.
You had Zodiac, 7, Fight Club. And
Fight Club, Social Network.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course.
So I quite enjoy David Fincher movies. I do find that some of his lesser movies don't really hit as strong. Something like Panic Room isn't a David Fincher movie. Mm-hmm. And The Killer feels definitely a step above something like Panic Room, but a step below some of his greater works. I think it's, if we're like looking at his more recent works, I had five. I had The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo on there too.
Yeah, John just likes Russian movies and David Fincher, so this is really his favorite podcast we've ever done.
There we go. But I feel like this is like just, it's below that Fight Club step. It's below like Gone Girl, but it's above kind of that lesser work for Fincher. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that comes through in the stylization of this. I think the opening scene of this movie is actually really well done and like caught me immediately.
Yeah.
And as the story developed, I know it's based on a graphic novel and everything. I just felt like I didn't like the direction it was taking.
Well, it felt, the problem was, and I understand what the point of it was, but what the problem with the movie was is you never got anything above surface level to the point where it was like, what is his actual relationship with anyone? And I guess the point is there is no relationship with anyone, but clearly he's going on a non-personal manhunt across the world to avenge, you know, whatever happened to his girlfriend, wife, whatever she is. And it's got to count for something. So I would have liked to seen a little bit more of that. And I think that's where like, that's what prevents this movie from being 3.5. Right. Because if you look at, there are movies out there where it is very much a like sociopath type person, a psychopath type person, whatever it is, where they're very cut and dry. They don't want to have relationships, anything like that. But the movie manages to bridge that gap and show the world a little bit differently. He really was a robot in this movie, and it was a fun performance from Fassbender. Again, it really worked, but the story starts to lack a little bit when you're sitting there saying, okay, where's it going to go next? And it felt like you were watching vignettes of things that were happening rather than watching a cohesive story for the entirety of the film.
Yeah, it's kind of broken up that way in the way that it has like the, what is it, 5-6 chapters in the movie too. Yeah. And it feels that way. They don't feel... There obviously is this overarching story, but they don't feel connected at the same time. When you start the movie with this very compelling sequence of Michael Fassbender just giving us voiceover of him observing, trying to find his target, and waiting for the opportune moment, and then blowing it for the first time ever, it's so compelling. And the way it's shot, the way... I really appreciated the way Fincher used diegetic music in this when Fassbender's listening to the Smiths. And
oh, he listens to the Smiths in this?
Oh, no. I mean,
sorry to interrupt.
How possibly? There were points where I was calling what Smith song was going to come on next.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, this is definitely what's going to happen now.
The greatest hits. But anyway, continue with your diegetic music point. Sorry.
But like when you hear it just in the background because it's in Michael Fassbender's character's ear. And then we get the street view and it's blaring because all of a sudden we realize we are Michael Fassbender in that moment. Mm-hmm. It's a good way of showing that without having to like explicitly state anything. And it really goes to show Fincher understanding his subject matter here. But at the same time, like the script just feels so thin because why does this turn into like a John Wick movie?
Yeah. I mean, I get, you know, he's going one at a time, killing off the people to get to the client. You know, he's cleaning up the trail or whatever it is. But yeah, I mean, the brute scene, the fight scene in the brute section of this movie was great. I mean, it was really well done. But I do agree with you that I need more of an emotion. And, you know, John Wick is so simple because he has the epic line of "they killed my dog." Boom. Yep. Got it done. Moving on. You know, like the fact that this movie doesn't have that moment is what prevents it from being at that John Wick level. Technically, it's amazing. I mean, you talked about the sound already, but the direction, the movie itself, like it unfolds properly. It's a really, really well-made movie. You can tell that this is David Fincher making this movie because if this is in the hands of a lesser director, this is a 2-star movie. Like this is probably a bad movie. But again, this kind of goes back a little bit to it's a Netflix movie. I can count the number of Netflix movies I've enjoyed on one hand, and most of them aren't English Netflix movies. Most of them are international Netflix movies that just get put on Netflix because. And the thing is, if this was a regular studio, if this was going out into theaters, would they have made David Fincher sit down and really figure out what he was going to do with this character? Because Fassbender gives an Oscar-worthy performance. Like, there's no, that's no joke. He really does. However, there's no depth. There's not enough depth to the character to elevate this movie. And I think that that's again, where this going out to a streamer, they don't need to look at it so many times. They just need to make sure people are going to click it because that's Michael Fassbender and that's David Fincher. And you know what? It took us 3 months to watch this movie. And mm-hmm. I've already watched 12 or 13 movies this year. And it took me three months to get to this one.
Yeah. It's just, there was always something else coming out. So I kind of understand why they didn't put it out in theaters at the same time. But it just felt like it was missing something. And again, I don't know if that's because it's translating from a graphic novel. When was the last time we talked about a movie that just came straight from a graphic novel?
Yeah, I don't know. And I was actually going to say, I didn't realize that this was a graphic novel. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a French graphic novel, I believe. And the screenwriter for it is the same person who wrote Seven.
Yeah.
So like, it's someone who's worked with Fincher closely, has created a phenomenal neo-noir thriller with him. And again, like, all the parts are there for this movie to be incredible, but it just doesn't get there because it's lacking that character depth. Because in making this character so detached from the world, there's nothing for us as an audience to relate to.
Yeah.
And like that's kind of the issue with these like sociopath film protagonists in general. It's almost impossible for an audience to connect with them. And that's why we see so many people being like, okay, this isn't a great movie when we have that as our main protagonist. You can't connect with them, and movies have to make you feel something. The fact is, Phil, you came in here describing like this inciting incident as his girlfriend or wife or whatever. It's never explained in the movie what the relationship he has with this woman is.
Yeah, we know it's Marcus's sister. Why do I care that it's Marcus's sister, but not care how it's related to my protagonist that is in literally every scene of this movie? This is Chinatown level. He's in every single scene of this movie. There's no scenes without him. So why do I care that it's Marcus's sister? Tell me how he's actually related to her. Are they in love? I mean, I get my sister loves you. Okay, but what does that mean? Where he's going home, but what does that mean? I need more than that, because also, he's going home. Why would they go there and just beat the living daylights out of her and not even kill her? And when he's not even there, I don't know. It felt a little forced. I needed to know more of who that was. And like you said, I mean, this is from a writer who knows how to write. There's no doubt about that, but maybe they tried too hard to keep it in the vein of the graphic novel. I don't know.
Maybe.
I just feel like there was so much more potential to do something else with this that they just didn't do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the biggest potential, quite like for me in this film, is the scene with Tilda Swinton, because that is a phenomenally acted scene from both sides. Well, it is stupendous seeing Fassbender and Swinton just feed off each other in this scene that's so tense. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like there's a release to that tension ever.
Yeah, I get that. I loved that scene, and I thought it was so well done. And it left me kind of being like, ooh. But okay, so here's what I appreciate about this movie, and it's based around that scene, is each section kind of was its own thing, right? You had the brute where there was no dialogue. You had the opening, which was all voiceover. You had the part at the end, not the epilogue, but the client. You had that scene, which was something. You had the lawyer scene, where it's kind of like outsmarting the people who are bringing. And then you had this scene, which was like the expert. So this is somebody who's on his level. And if you notice, she's getting ready to stab him when he kills her. She has the knife out and is ready to stab him. So he saw that coming. And I think that's really cool. Like, that's a really good moment. And it's set up through the dialogue of how she is downplaying how serious of a threat she is to Michael Fassbender's character. So like, yeah, the Tilda Swinton stuff was great, but I guess that's what's tough about a movie like this. When you're trying to do six distinct chapters the way it is, you can't be bringing characters back at another point, because the whole point of this movie is that he's wiping the slate clean one person at a time, which is kind of the irony of at the end. Oh, they told me that I could clean the slate, that it would be fine. I didn't realize they were going to kill you. And that's literally what Fassbender's doing, but he realizes that to do it, he's going to kill people. So it's funny how that was like that off. What do you call it? The way that those two things offset, whatever it is, you get it. But anyway, so yeah, the Tilda Swinton scene was great though. And Tilda Swinton's such a great actor. She's just so weird that it's hard to like, really, I mean, I'd ask this, and obviously she's in Doctor Strange, but other than Doctor Strange, what do audiences know her for the most? Like if you were to say Tilda Swinton to somebody and they had never seen Doctor Strange, what movie would you say to them? Well, you've seen her in this. What would be your go-to?
Is it The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
I don't know. I didn't even know she was in that because I saw that when I was like a child, so I don't even remember.
I know. And like that's the thing, is like how many people revisit that movie? If I'm thinking like a big movie, I mean, I'm going to talk about something like We Need to Talk About Kevin, but how many people have actually seen that movie?
Exactly. And like she's in a bunch of Wes Anderson movies, but how many people actually realize who Tilda Swinton is in those movies? Mm-hmm. Like in The Grand Budapest Hotel, she's pretty much hidden behind wigs and makeup. In Moonrise Kingdom, she plays a character called Social Services. Like it's funny because we know Tilda Swinton. Cinephiles know Tilda Swinton. And Tilda Swinton's a phenomenal actress. I mean, she won the Oscar for Michael Clayton way back in 2005 or six, whatever year it was. But it's like she gets to show off in a movie like this, but also she's not fighting for a meatier role because she's just so out there and she's not the household name she probably should have been because of that. So yeah, I was kind of surprised that when it comes out at the end, oh, and Tilda Swinton, I'm like, oh great. And then the whole movie, I'm like, when is Tilda Swinton coming? When is Tilda Swinton coming?
Yeah,
and really her scene wasn't any longer than the other sections. Like I would almost guarantee that each of these sections was 15 minutes long or 10, 12 minutes long with a prologue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's not a meteor scene. It's the same. Yeah, it's pretty much the exact same length, but it's also kind of the issue sometimes with casting in a movie like this and having opening credits that reveal that, because you're just anticipating it. Because when you see a name like Tilda Swinton and she's not the wife, you then have to anticipate she's one of the assailants, which means or the client, right? And you're building up to that moment. And you're like, okay, I want this big reveal. And in this movie, it's incredibly satisfying, but it's almost satisfying to the point where it's like, okay, nothing can actually top this scene now.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how I felt. It felt like the climax of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we actually get to the client, it's not climactic because the climax happened already.
Yeah. I do like the de-escalation of everything in the client. I like it as a close for the film. I like the subtle details about some of these things, like when he's going into the fitness club and he bumps into the janitor to steal his key card.
Yeah.
And then like complains about him ripping his jacket. And it's like, yes, this is the exact type of place where you could get away with doing something like that, because this guy can't say anything to you because of how much money you're paying to be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I like those details. I like the fact that he prefaces that entire section saying, you know, the more money you have, the more people are going to look for who killed you.
Yeah. Yeah.
It like builds up to everything. And while some people might find the ending dissatisfying because, I mean, spoiler, he doesn't kill the client, but I enjoyed that because now it's kind of showing this level of this character that we haven't had at that point. It's a calculated character. We've had that the entire movie, but we haven't had the calculated to the point where he wants to do something after this. We never had like the survivability of this character really examined up until this point.
Yeah. And then he just goes home.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, I go home and that's it. And really it was because that guy wasn't a threat to him. Everybody else along the line was some sort of threat to him. Cause it goes from Claiborne to Tilda Swinton, and it goes down the line, you know, it start, and then it's eventually, hey, we're going to tell you now because you're the one who's actually going to go perform the kill. So he works his way up the line. And yeah, you see a little bit of empathy there. Same thing as when the pit bull's chasing him, most people would have just had the dog get shot by the character there. But
yeah,
for him to go out of his way to not kill that dog is giving you the sympathy for that character that you didn't have throughout most of this movie. So it, like those little things are good. And again, that's where I go back to. This is a really well-made movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, that's all there is to it. It's like a really well-made movie, but this is a movie that today's January 10th. On January 17th, I'm going to forget this movie. I'm going to forget almost everything that happened in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Which it feels weird to say about a David Fincher movie. Yeah. It feels weird going into an award season and not talking about David Fincher at all.
Yeah. Especially when he had a movie come out. It feels like almost every single time he has a movie come out, it's at least getting discussed. Even if it doesn't get nominated like a Zodiac, it's still brought up.
Yeah. And it still has a lot. A lot of Fincher movies have these cult followings. I don't know if this one will. I don't know if it can. I mean, does anyone remember the last movie that David Fincher made?
Was it Mank?
It was Mank.
Here's a question. Can a Netflix or direct-to-streaming movie get a cult following?
That's kind of a question we have to ask. And I mean, that is a conversation that's happened a lot in this streaming era, is these movies. We look at movies that do have cult followings. Things like Zodiac, for instance, right? Those cult followings came from bargain bins at your local grocery store. At
Rocky Walmart. Horror Picture Show. It was, you would have to go find the DVD or VHS, or you could go watch one of the showings of it in a movie theater.
Yeah.
You know, Eraserhead, that was the same. It was the same shit. Like, that's how people found those movies. And now, like, you throw a movie on Netflix, it can't be a cult hit because it's on Netflix. It's on the biggest streaming service in the world. So it can't be a cult hit no matter what.
Yeah, and how likely is it somebody 5 years from now just comes across this movie? The way that algorithms work on Netflix and everything, it's almost impossible.
Especially like Netflix just kicked everybody out, right? So like not too long ago, so it finally came back to haunt us. So we had to redo our entire Netflix. And what are the first 25 things that pop up on the new Netflix that I have? It's all Netflix original shit. And it's all like their TV shows and like nonsense movies. It's their movies that they clearly put more money behind. The Killer wasn't on there. You know, I had to look
hard for The Killer on Netflix.
Yeah, which is crazy because when Netflix originally started, when it put out Beasts of No Nation, that was like, oh my God, everybody come watch Beasts of No Nation. Look how big of a deal this is. It's Beasts of No Nation. It's not the case now. Like, it's not the case. They've oversaturated their market and they're not making money on this stuff. Like, I understand Netflix had a good quarter or whatever it was. It's because they did this. You can't share passwords anymore. Mm-hmm. Once the sharing of passwords thing is over, they're done. I mean, really, like Netflix, like here's my bold air quotes prediction. I don't even think it's bold. And maybe people are already like, dude, like, what are you talking about? Netflix won't exist in 10 years. I'm telling you, I really believe that. I really firmly believe maybe it'll exist in some capacity of like, you know, it's where streaming stuff kind of goes to die, but Netflix will, it's going to go the way of Blockbuster. And I know like people are going to be like, what? There's no way. Netflix has been around for a long time at this point. And when you think about like Blockbuster was founded in 85, I'm looking this up right now, was founded in 85. At its peak in 2004, it was killing it. And then in 2014, everything was closed. So you're talking 30 years, right? That's how long Blockbuster was around for. So if you go Netflix and you know, I have to do this. If you go to Netflix, it launched in 2007. We're 3 years away from the 20-year anniversary of Netflix.
Is that of the streaming service or of the DVD delivery service?
It was the DVD rental service. And then where was... I don't know when it started doing streaming. I'm not 100% sure when it started doing streaming. No, transition to streaming services was 2007 to 2012.
Okay.
So in January of 2007, the company launched a streaming service. So from 97, so here you go, this is even better. From 97 to 2006, it was DVDs. And then 2000, so we're coming up 3 years from now, it'll be 30 years.
Yep.
And you figure with the transitions and everything like that, I am telling you, 2034, if me and John are doing this podcast, Netflix will not be a thing anymore. I'm telling you, it's not going to be a thing anymore. Maybe that's a hot take. I don't know. Raptor says it would be fitting for Netflix to go the way of Blockbuster. I think it's going to happen. And the reason is movies like The Killer, movies like Mank gets Oscar nominations. Nobody gives a shit that Mank exists anymore. We did a podcast series where we talked all about David Fincher movies. In our top 100 movies, we talked about so many David Fincher movies. Sure, we don't talk about The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, but that's somebody else's cup of tea. That's not our cup of tea. But now a movie like Mank, which gets nominated for Best Picture, is directed by David Fincher, has Gary Oldman, is written by Mankiewicz. Like, this is amazing. And guess what? We don't care anymore. And it's his most recent movie other than The Killer. That's why these streaming services are going to go the way of Blockbuster. They're going to not exist. And honestly, I'm getting to the point where people like having physical media again. I never thought I'd say those words, but you are slowly starting to see the shift where people are starting to like having physical media again.
Did you know VHSs are coming into style again?
Dude, it's like vinyls, except I hate to tell everybody, it looks like shit. Everything on a VHS looks like shit. Don't watch it on a VHS. Just go watch it on a Blu-ray, because everything looks like shit on a VHS.
But like that's the point we're getting to, where people are like being nostalgic for VHSs. It's hard to find certain movies on VHS now. Like, it was already hard because everyone like burned all their VHSs. But if you go and try to find like a horror movie on VHS, it's almost impossible, because that market has grown so much. And those movies are actually worth some money now.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is crazy.
And if we're getting to a point where people are appreciating VHS again, streaming services like don't stand a chance.
They don't. And I'll tell you what, I don't think they stand a chance. I think it's over.
No.
I think it's over. And Raptor says that's good news. I still got a load of VHSs. I mean, my family never got rid of them. We have so many. Yeah. But VHSs, it looks so bad. It looks so bad.
Does. It looks like you have to do it for the vibe of a VHS. Like, the only thing I ever want to watch is like 80s, 90s horror movies on VHS, because that is the vibe. But anything else, like, there are better means of watching some of these movies.
Yeah, and I mean, even nowadays, you can watch an 80s, 90s horror movie that's been like remastered to look like an 80s or 90s movie, but on Blu-ray. Like, if you go watch The House of the Devil, which I know is like 2007 or 2008, that movie looks like it was made in the 80s, even when you watch it on Blu-ray. It doesn't matter. That's the style in which it was made. So, I mean, that's kind of getting off track, but there's really not much more to talk about with The Killer. So it's kind of just like, it's a good movie. It's not great. It's not bad. But it is proof. The proof is in the pudding, right? And that is the case here with The Killer and with Netflix and stuff like that. They're just putting out so much, and everything seems like a response to everything else. Mm-hmm. And it's not working.
No. And I will say, it gets a little overshadowed by the presence of the Smiths in this movie. Cause again, there's like 8 or 9 Smith songs in this movie. Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor once again deliver a phenomenal score for David Fincher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I knew you were going to bring that up, so I waited. You know, I figured I'd let you do it, but yeah, it is.
It's so subtle. And like, it's again, it was so obvious that as soon as I heard it, I was like, oh, of course it's Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor. Like, who else would be writing a script or writing a score for David Fincher? But the subtlety they bring to a score just really fits the cinematic style Fincher puts out there.
Yeah, it does. It does. It fits his movies. And like, even like that weird title sequence, like it was very Seven. Where you have, Andrew Kevin Walker writing the script. You have Atticus Finch doing the score, or Atticus Ross doing the score. Atticus Finch. Yeah, we had the guy from Kill a Mockingbird doing the score. Yeah. But anyway, I agree. I mean, it was, again, it's well done. Mm-hmm. I wish there was more to it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I feel.
But anyway, somebody hold me to that. I got to remember to mark this as the video where I talked about Netflix ending by 2034, but I'm gonna be honest, I think it's gonna be way quicker than that. I wouldn't be surprised if we got like 5 years of it. I know streaming is always gonna be streaming. It's too easy. It's the same reason why YouTube exists in such a big capacity, why we're able to do these podcasts and people listen to them and it's easy to find and all of that. But yeah, I don't know. I just shrugged my shoulders. All right, let's jump into this. The most authentically Russian movie I have watched and discussed with John, and like, when I think of Russia, this is what I think of. This is Mother Russia right here. Screw all of John's other movies. This is Mother Russia. But no, okay. So I'll start with Black Widow, and then I'll let you jump in, because I know you had a really rough time watching this one. But here's why Black Widow, I gave it 2.5 stars. Okay, first of all, Florence Pugh is so good in this movie. I have no idea why
she can't deny that.
Yeah. Her performance is stupid good in this movie. I kept waiting for her to slip out of the Russian accent, and she didn't. And I was really impressed the entire time. David Harbour's a cartoon. I never really thought David Harbour was that good of an actor. Anyway, he's just kind of a cartoon in this. That I get that's what he's supposed to be, but you know, whatever. Rachel Weisz does whatever Rachel Weisz does, and Scarlett Johansson is really just Black Widow. But what I appreciated about this movie, though, was, other than Florence Pugh, was it tried to be different from the other Marvel movies. And early on, and then it falls into the normal bullshit of, oh, we got to blow up the building. We're going to kill the guy. Everything's going to fall apart. We came up with some scheme that you guys didn't know about. We have the big boss scene, and then it ends. But I appreciated at the beginning of this movie that it was trying to go a little bit darker, that it was trying to go a little bit more the way of espionage. It was trying to be, for lack of a better term, a movie. It felt like it was trying to be a movie. It didn't feel like it was trying to exist just in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I have no idea why it is the 24th movie in this franchise and doesn't come out earlier. I don't know, like, say, when it chronologically should have come out. However, that aside, and we can talk about that later, I at least appreciated the effort that went into this one. And again, going back to my rating system, 2 stars means I felt nothing. I watched Lilies of the Field this week with Sidney Poitier because I wanted to watch his movie that won, you know, where he won Best Actor. I felt nothing. So then I was like, let me go look up what won Best Picture that year because I knew that was nominated. Tom Jones won it. What did I give Tom Jones? 2 stars. So I looked up Best Supporting Actress from that year because I wanted to see who beat the girl from Lilies of the Field. It wasn't any of the Tom Jones actresses, but there were 3 Tom Jones actresses who were nominated for Best Supporting Actress. I couldn't tell you what a single one of them did in the movie because that's how numb I was to the movie. That's a 2-star movie. 1.5 means I did not like it while I was watching it. 1 means I hated it while I was watching it. And 0.5-star lower just means, like, this is a steaming pile of shit. Why did I waste my time? I felt more than nothing while watching Black Widow. And I was never really mad at this movie the way I was mad at Captain Marvel. I appreciated some of the effort, but then it just gets so freaking lazy in the last 45 minutes that you're just like, okay, whatever. Just end so that I can put it in my letterbox, then move on and keep being told that my favorite genre is superheroes and action sequences or whatever the hell
letterbox God.
At this point. Yeah. So anyway, go ahead. Give us your spiel.
So I came into when I originally saw Black Widow when it first came out, with all the debacle that it was, with like going to Disney Plus and then getting a theatrical release and everything. I went and saw it in theaters, and this was, you know, right after Far From Home, which I clearly said I enjoyed last week. And, you know, I'm still kind of digging Marvel movies at this point. And I think this is the point where I started realizing how bad Marvel movies are. Mm-hmm. Because this movie, I can't do it. It's so bad. I didn't rate it as my lowest Marvel movie. I think I have it as 3rd lowest right now. Mm-hmm. But there are so many questions I have coming out of this movie that this movie should have answered. And it makes me mad that we are getting a prequel at this point,
mm-hmm.
a prequel to the largest cinematic event we have ever had that shouldn't have come out this late. It's only coming out this late because everyone was so mad that, you know, they kill off Natasha without giving her a solo movie.
Yep.
And the only thing keeping this from being my least favorite Marvel movie is Florence Pugh. That's it.
Yeah.
Because she is so good in this movie. Like you said, it's, I don't understand how she gives such a good performance when the script is terrible. Some of the dialogue in this movie is atrocious.
I've been dealing with that for 24 movies.
I know. Now. I know we've been dealing with it with Marvel movies. There were some like explicitly bad moments in this one. Mm. There's this idea of found family, which is kind of what the Avengers theme is, and it doesn't quite make sense in this movie. It doesn't make sense where they're going with it. Rachel Weisz is a throwaway character.
Yeah.
How do you have Rachel Weisz in your movie and have her as a throwaway character that doesn't even do anything? She gets one scene in this movie, and that's it. The villain of the movie, like Dragunov, whatever, sure, is a Bond villain. Very explicitly foreshadowed with the weird scene from Moonraker in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. That's why I said, was that the only one they gave the rights to?
No, It's because a satellite falls to the Earth. It's the one that's most relevant to the plot of this movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I also struggled with that. I was going through it and I was thinking, having, you know, seen the movie already, being able to see that, hey, this is a Moonraker scene, which is weird because everyone hates Moonraker. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even feel like the best James Bond movie for what's going on. There are better James Bond analogs you could have used in this movie that would have made this more interesting. I would have much preferred if Taskmander ended up being Rachel Weisz's character and they showed us Goldeneye in that scene instead of Moonraker, because that makes more sense. A Trevelyan plot, like plot twist here, much better than whatever they decided, because in the end, these villains have no connection to Natasha. Yes, Dragunov is like in charge of the Red Room, which like brainwashed her and made her a Russian spy and stuff. But at the same time, like, they're kind of introducing this fact that she was brainwashed the entire time. It's been mentioned before, but they haven't really delved into it and why. And when we see her so young, you have to wonder why there's brainwashing, because you could just indoctrinate people that young.
Yeah, did you, you watched The Americans, right?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite shows of all time.
This is the lazy version of The Americans. Like, this is the 2.5-star version of The Americans.
Same comparison.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the lazy version of the Americans, where it's like Russian family living in America has to go into hiding, you know, or is trying to stay hidden, because really they don't go into hiding in The Americans. But, you know, and then it's like, well, our daughter is going to be who we kind of try to recruit and do whatever. Mm-hmm. The Red Room stuff is like fine. The antidote is so simple. And that's, again, where I go back to it. It gets so lazy in the second half of this movie, where rather than fighting them all off, she just like claps her hands and then does it with Olga Karolinko too. And I was laughing because at the part where Taskmaster takes the hat off or the hood off, and Scarlett Johansson's reaction to that, her face in my head, I was like, with Scarlett Johansson going, oh my God, it's Olga Karolinko. That's where she's been. I was wondering where the hell she's been. Like, Olga Karolinko hasn't been in shit in so long. And again, like, the problem with this is, I don't mind Black Widow having her own movie. And honestly, like I said, I gave it 2.5 stars. The movie itself didn't offend me. But it's the fact of, why is this the story? Why is this the character? Like, why is this where you chose to put it in? Why is this the plot line you went with? It makes sense that it happens in between what? It happens right before Civil War, right after Civil War.
Civil War, before Infinity War.
That's what it is. So you get that. Like, I appreciate that. But then why not just put the movie out during that time? Because now at this point, I don't care about Black Widow at all, because she's already dead in the bigger scheme of things. And this movie doesn't actually do anything to advance the plot. Maybe the last scene with Florence Pugh and Julia Louis-Dreyfus does. But I know that the rest of this movie does nothing for the entire series. So it just kind of is what it is. That being said, the movie didn't piss me off to the level I thought. Maybe it was just a way of having such low expectations that the movie wasn't going to make me mad. But in terms of like, oh, well, they had the Red Room and stuff. I mean, none of that really did it for me. I was shocked. And I know you gave it 1.5 stars and I know you really disliked it. But I'm saying this more from the perspective of somebody who's been watching these movies, has been seeing what the reviews are on them and all that. I was a little surprised that this only had a 2.9 on Letterboxd. That was much lower than I thought it was going to be, because like, I know the way some of these movies are discussed, and I know how sometimes like the Marvel people will just kind of give movies a good review to give them a good review anyway.
Yeah.
So I was a little surprised that this was as low as it was, because I felt like for a Marvel fan, if I was a Marvel fan, I feel like I would have enjoyed this so much. Like, so, I mean, maybe I enjoyed it because I wasn't a Marvel fan, but I don't know.
I think for me, it's just a weird thing. First off, you have Taskmaster, who is a really compelling villain, and you've ruined him. Like, you ruined him. And again, making him not connected to Natasha. It's
Olga Karolinko.
Because it's a female character in this universe. Making her not connected to Natasha feels weird. You're going for this theme of, like, sisterhood with, like, within the widows and all of that. And other than this very natural sister relationship that Natasha and Yelena have immediately upon re-meeting each other, the only time we really see it is that weird like sisterhood thing at the end of the movie when the Black Widows come and they grab Taskmaster and they're like, yeah, we're better now.
Yeah.
It's weird. Like, the themes don't hit. Also, you have an established spy as the main character of this movie, and you decided not to just make this a spy movie through and through.
Well, and that's where I'm saying, like, I appreciated the first hour of this movie so much because it felt like they were going the spy route, and then they just jumped ship, you know? Yeah. And again, this is where it's so hard, because you have to lean into the expectations of your audience, right? Like, you don't have a choice but to lean into the expectations of your audience. Your audience doesn't want a full-blown spy movie. That's not what they want. And after this movie was over, there might be some massive Marvel fans who were like, oh, I wish that would have just been this version or whatever. But had that been the version, they wouldn't have been happy with it. There's no way they would have been happy with it. So I don't know. If they would have went the spy route, this is a much better movie. But in the MCU, that's not what they can do. You know, like, they can't subvert the expectations that much.
Which is unfortunate, because we've talked about it several times, where the MCU is the best when it's doing genre film and it's not just a superhero movie. And this could have been, this as the beginning of a new phase, was the opportunity to do that. Because instead, what they got was a movie that released, had very low critical and public response, and kind of bittered everyone's taste after all the goodwill they had built up over a decade leading up to, or more than a decade leading up to it.
I think what also hurt this movie, and talking about it in the greater context of like what was going on in society, this was definitely hurt by the fact after the COVID break, you know, we'll call it a break, after 2 years of not having a Marvel movie and having COVID hit, and like how long, I mean, I saw this trailer 9,000 times. When she says, "That's not my story," I have flashbacks to wearing a mask and sitting in my in-law's house and like shaking like violently. But the fact that this was the first one after so long, I think played into that, because the buzz and the expectations were so high. And it's not really the movie's fault, because if this would have been released when it should have been released in 2020, nobody would have cared. I think it would have been fine. But I think the public soured on it so much more, because after so long, it's the same way people with Tenet absolutely despise Tenet.
Yeah.
It's because there was an expectation and it was like, oh my God, finally we're getting these movies. When you drop the ball on those, that's going to piss people off.
If you look at my original Letterboxd review for this movie,
it was brutal.
It is brutal. It's bad. Yeah. I was relentless in that review. But one of the lines that really stuck out to me was, if you have delayed a movie for over a year, how has no one looked over it and said it could be better?
I'm sure they did. Okay, so here's the one defense I'll give that movie for this one. There was really nothing they could do. They had the footage
had. Yeah, that's true.
And they didn't know if they were going to be able to film again with all the COVID restrictions. Yeah, you didn't know if you were going to be able to pull off. I get that. Now, when Disney comes out with their Snow White movie, you know, next year or this year, whenever the hell it's coming out, that will be unforgiving. And I'll just copy and paste your review from this and be like, how? Yeah, you delayed this for a year. Did you not make this better? So, it's tough, because it's almost like, okay, so let's say it's 2024 now.
Yes.
COVID was predominant, was the major conversation in 2020. Obviously, that bled into 2021. In some places, it bled into 2022. But we're 2024 now. We are removed from like the craziest part of COVID. We kind of know what we're dealing with now. There's vaccines. There's medications you can take to reduce the effects. People kind of know how to treat it. Like, you're not being thrown on a ventilator as soon as you come into the hospital anymore. That's just not what they're doing. Yeah. And so I think it is a little difficult to get back into the exact place we were in 2020. Mm-hmm. 2020 is a time capsule year. 2020 is a year that will never be touched. By the time another year like 2020 happens, we'll all be dead. So it won't matter. Like, everybody, you could be an infant listening to this. You will be dead too. Like, we are all going to be gone by the time another year like 2020 happens. That's a once in 120 year kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's almost hard to realize how crazy that was and impacting things. So we're still seeing the impact in TV shows and movies, in sporting events. Like, you still see the impact a little bit. It still bleeds over into theme parks, Disney's theme parks. I mean, their attendance, whatever. But like with Black Widow, I hate that I'm defending a Marvel movie, because why should I do this? If you want to hate it, I should jump in with you. But with this movie, it's like, man, I almost feel for them at that point. Because even if they did realize it was a bad movie, in 2020, there was literally nothing you could do. Like, there was nothing. You think now, oh, well, they could have done the COVID test and they could have done this. They could have. Nobody did anything for the entire year.
Yeah.
You couldn't do anything. And like, I was living in Los Angeles through all of that. You couldn't walk outside. When I was living in my apartment, I couldn't walk outside to my car without being told to put a mask on. Like, it was such a different world, and they weren't filming things. So even if they realized it was bad, I don't know if they were putting the editors and stuff through it. And in Los Angeles, you were making a hell of a lot of money doing unemployment instead of working. Trust me, I know, because I was on unemployment and I made a lot more money than people who were working. So whatever. Yeah. I'm just
But at the same time, like, it's this weird struggle of like, if a movie's been pushed back, can you push it back further? Especially when they had the whole debacle about whether or not this movie should get a theatrical release. Because they were going to put it straight to Disney Plus, just like they had, what was it, Mulan, they did that with prior to this movie.
And Soul was before this, right?
Yes, I believe so. I think so.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a contract. I don't know if you know this, but there was a contract dispute because Scarlett Johansson's contract explicitly stated the movie had to have a theatrical release.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of people don't realize that a lot of those movies do. That's a big time thing. Yeah.
And that because of that, a lot of people soured on Scarlett Johansson and didn't want to see this movie.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many different levels as to like why this movie failed. But in the end, it comes down to the fact none of this movie feels earned, and there's no stakes in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know your protagonist can't die, because you know she dies in like three movies that take place after this. So you know she can't die. Now you have these ancillary characters and these side characters who you don't care about because you're just being introduced to them. You're kind of being told you're supposed to care about them, but you're never really given a reason to, with the exception of Yelena, who's kind of the main character of this movie.
Yeah, she's more interesting. And I think she's more interesting because it's the first time we're seeing her, but she's definitely more interesting.
Yeah, and part of that's also probably because of Florence's performance in the role. But after watching the movie this week, I realized that like this movie kind of just explained why Natasha had a vest in Infinity War.
I love that that was your takeaway from this. So go ahead and explain that, and then I want to kind of get into logistics here of why this movie was released when it was. But you go and talk about the vest first, John.
So when Natasha shows up in Infinity War, she has this vest with her blonde hair and stuff. And I guess people cared enough, or Disney thought people cared enough, that they had to explain how she got this vest. So it's a main plot point in this movie. It's brought up like 3 or 4 times, this vest. And then Yelena gives it to Natasha. And at the end of the movie, all I can think is this the point of this movie? So Natasha gets a vest? Because we haven't seen any payoff of like the Black Widows being broken free. We didn't even know the Black Widows existed.
I thought she was alone. We all thought she was alone in this whole thing. They never hinted in any of the other
movies. They never hinted at like this brainwashing thing. The last time we saw brainwashing was in Civil War with Bucky, and that was a lot different type of brainwashing because it wasn't chemical. And it seems to be a lot harder to get people out of, too, I might add.
Yeah.
But My major concern with this movie, and what really brings this movie down for me, is throughout a lot of things, we're told about Budapest. Although I will note, in the Avengers, they call it Budapest. And then we have a scene in this movie where Scarlett Johansson explicitly explains to someone it's pronounced Budapest.
They love doing the retrofitting, man. They love doing the retrofitting.
Yeah.
Whatever it's called, retconning. Thank you. Retconning. Yeah, they love doing that because they get the backlash from the fans, and then they say, "Oh shit, I guess we should change that because the fans want us to."
But we're told about Budapest. We're told about this relationship between Clint and Natasha that builds up there, and then we're told that the entire mission was she was supposed to assassinate this guy to prove that she could work for SHIELD, and like we still know nothing about why Clint was there, what their relationship was like, what the tension was like. There are arrow holes in the wall. What does that mean? And yeah. they were holed up in a ventilation shaft for 2 days. What does that mean? Why were they hiding in a vent for 2 days? Like, we're not told any of the things that we actually wanted to know about Natasha's character. Instead, we're given all this new story that doesn't really make sense in the world that we've been given. And if the fact that, like, Dragunov survived this assassination, why is Natasha allowed to be in S.H.I.E.L.D. in the first place? You're telling me that this massive American intelligence agency couldn't find out this guy was still alive.
Yeah, I know. I know. And especially like Nick Fury, right? Didn't they just highlight that in the previous movie of how he's always so skeptical? And then he wasn't because Captain Marvel's stupid. Because they, you know, it's whatever, yes. the Skrulls or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I get the frustrations. Like, there's no denying it. And I'll never understand why this movie came out. It did. Because when I saw it, I was like, oh, so maybe like when they do the snap, she comes back and then she's like in the movie. And I can totally see at this point where why people start to lose interest in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And that's because like everything that you've grown to love and like care about is now leaving. It's all going away. So what the hell do we care? Like you're going to stop caring because the characters and stuff are dying. They're keeping them away. You're introducing new stuff. So like, I understand why people are starting to lose interest. They should have just ended it at the end of phase three, but they couldn't help themselves. You had asked earlier, if you're already delaying a movie, why can't you just delay it more?
Yep.
Well, here's why. Up until this point, so obviously Disney was taking a bath on all of their big movies that were supposed to come out, all their Pixar movies, all that stuff. They released Raya and the Last Dragon. It made $130 million worldwide. It had a budget of $100 million. $100 million plus. They don't really know.
Yeah.
The problem is that would be fine. I mean, that wouldn't be a disaster at this point. I mean, it only made $54 million domestically, which Disney was probably happy with because, again, this was 2021. Theaters were shutting down randomly. I mean, LA, New York, they'd be open, then they'd close, then they'd be open, then they'd close. I mean, it was all over the place. You didn't know what to expect. $54 million is not bad. But this is a company now that for a year has had $0 in box office for movies that are costing them over $100 million. They're still having to pay people with unemployment and whatever, blah, blah, blah. And it goes right down the line. They're still paying things out. So you had that. Cruella came out right after that and made a boatload of money. $235 million worldwide.
I forgot that movie existed.
Yeah, but it made a lot of money. But the reason why they couldn't push Black Widow back any further was because you had movies like F9 coming out, Space Jam, A New Legacy, like these types of movies. And then Disney had their own movies with Jungle Cruise, and they needed to get the Marvel movies going again because they already had them on the docket.
Yeah,
Black Widow made $165 million or $183 million, whatever it was. It made $183 million domestically, $379 million worldwide. So it did great. And they needed the money more than they needed something that was good. And isn't that honestly,
just the MCU in general?
But honestly, if you really consider this, and I don't think I don't really care to make you move your rating, but I do have to say this. If you really consider everything Black Widow was up against and that this was blatantly going to be a money grab from Disney by the time they actually released it, this movie could have been so much worse than it was.
It's very true. I don't disagree with that. Yeah. I don't disagree with that at all. It could have all been that final scene. There's that scene as the Red Room's falling and Yelena's on top of the helicopter. The green screening in that scene is some of the most atrocious green screening I have ever seen.
2021. Like, what?
That could have been the entire movie. So at least we didn't have that.
That was so bad. I talk a lot of shit about the CGI in these movies throughout this podcast as it is, but I could not believe how bad that looked. It was so terrible. But I mean, and that's one you can't even really blame on COVID because it's like, so the people couldn't use the machine right anymore. Like that's a guy sitting in his room alone making those effects look good. Woof, that was so bad.
Yeah. And I will say this about this movie. When I was rewatching it, I thought I was going to have to eat my own words. I thought I was going to get to a point where, you know, I was enjoying it because the first bit is kind of good. And then they get to Russia and it gets really bad.
It gets so bad.
Which is unfortunate because they're
just caricatures. Everybody wants to do the Russia stuff. Yeah.
Which is so unfortunate because this character is someone we've known since the third MCU movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been so nice to actually give this character justice and like for us to learn about her backstory. I think it was a wrong decision to make this movie when they made it, like setting wise. I think just doing Budapest would have been more interesting. Maybe they couldn't get Jeremy Renner for the movie, so maybe that's why they didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think there's so much more compelling stories we could have gotten for Black Widow other than making a movie focused on other characters, because the whole point is that she's in movies that focus on other characters, so we don't really get to know her, and we're still at that point. And as different as that opening sequence in Ohio is, first off, S.H.I.E.L.D. must be geniuses to hide any type of intelligence in Ohio, because who would ever guess it was there?
I do also like the idea of David Harbour flying on the wing of a plane from Ohio to Cuba. But anyway, continue. Yes.
But it's okay. He's a superhuman. He's a super soldier. He can do whatever he wants.
I mean, if you actually watch the plane land, he's not on the wing anymore, which is definitely an error because I don't know when he got up on the wing and walked into the plane. So you could say, oh, well, he just got in the plane. Okay, show me the scene of him getting in the plane.
Where?
I want to see
it. Yeah. But the point being is like... The point I'm trying to make, though, is that this Ohio scene, it's interesting. It gives us a little bit of backstory. But it kind of breaks what they're trying to build with this movie. Of this idea of, like, it was still a family. It was still real to Yelena. It was still real.
Mm-hmm.
When Natasha knows it's a farce the entire time. When Natasha knows it's a cover. Because she's already been trained. She's already been to the Red Room at that point. She already is, like, a spy. It doesn't work with the theme that they're trying to go for with the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I got nothing else to say about this movie. I don't know if you do, but I don't, because it is. And I'm happy we've made it past the COVID portion, because now we're into the post-COVID MCU movies. And I feel like we've hit the home stretch. And it's funny that we hit the home stretch with me liking a movie a hell of a lot more than you liked it.
Yeah.
Which just makes me laugh. But
almost all of these characters are coming back in an upcoming Marvel movie.
Including Black Widow?
Well, not the dead one.
Oh, okay. Okay, I didn't know.
Yelena's taken over the title of Black Widow.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that pretty much just what they've done? Like, Falcon took over Captain America. This is taking over. Like, they all just take over. And it's like, okay, what was the point then?
Yeah. Kind of. It's kind of
rude, just have them stay as their superhero. You know? Jason Obermeier says, do you guys believe in superhero fatigue or just bad quality ones? Oh, it's superhero fatigue, dude.
It's very clearly superhero fatigue at this point. Looking at movies for us to do for the Patreon podcast, I saw superhero movies and I was like, we can't talk about those.
You can't talk about them. I know. Which, by the way, if you're not a patron, we released our Mean Girls episode. So go listen to that. That was the first one we released. Yesterday, we also did The Terminator, but that's for patrons only. No, it's our lowest tier Patreon. It's our lowest tier. So go listen to the Mean Girls one. If you enjoyed that, every Tuesday, we're releasing a new episode. Terminator was last week. And what's next week, John? What are we next?
This week was The Mummy. Next week is Terminator.
There it is. I don't know, man. I can't figure that out. Okay. Anyway. And... yeah, next week we are doing the new Mean Girls, so that'll be our other movie that'll go along with Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings, which we'll see how I feel about that movie. But those are the next ones coming out. The new Mean Girls, I'm excited to see it. The reviews aren't that good. They're okay, I guess, but I feel like as more reviews start to trickle in, the number percentage is going to go down, down, down. My expectations weren't super high, but we'll see what it's all about when we get to it. So that'll be next week, probably Tuesday night. If John is able, because I can't do Wednesday night, so we'll talk about that and figure it out, but maybe Tuesday night.
Yes.
Also, if you are enjoying this movie coverage, the Phil and Will show tonight, Will and I are going to be doing it around 10:30 p.m., and I am going to talk a little bit about the Golden Globes, which I didn't watch a single second of, and I just think it's funny that a podcast called The Cinema Specialist didn't even mention the Golden Globes until 59 minutes in, like 2 days after it happened. I think that just shows how irrelevant the Golden Globes have become. And that's going to be something I'm going to talk about on that podcast tonight. So Let me know if you want to tune in for that. If you want to hear what I have to say about the Golden Globes, which used to be must watch TV in my house, where we would not watch Sunday Night Football. We would watch the Golden Globes. That's how much like what? as a guy growing up in New Jersey who really liked movies, like that's what we would go to. And it was Hollywood's biggest party. And now it's Hollywood's biggest shit show. It's just a disaster. So I can't wait to talk about that. And the fact that they had Barbie win cinematic and box office achievement or whatever the hell made up award they came up with for that one. So that'll be fun. We're going to be talking about that on the Phil and Will show tonight. But otherwise, become a patron, patreon.com/thespecialist. As we said, and as I can't get right, we did The Mummy last week. And we're doing The Terminator next week. But the Mean Girls one already came out. So if you want to check that out, go check it out over in our Patreon previews and think about becoming a patron. And we'll see everybody else next week when we talk about Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings and the new Mean Girls. First movie of 2024. Wow.
Yeah.